Scientists Speaking Out, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. It began as a simple idea, a march for science this weekend in Washington, D.C. And then the idea caught on from Europe.
We have to speak up again for science and for rational decisions. All these things we have been fighting for the last 50, 60 years.
To Africa.
We need science, especially when it comes to food security. That's essentially why we are marching.
Plus, when Sana Husseini was 7 years old, she visited a planetarium. She knew she wanted to work there, but was told she would need a PhD.
I didn't know what a PhD was. My best choice was like to go home and tell my mom I need a PhD. We'll go and buy it, and next thing, I'll be back there.
Oh, if only life were that simple. An astronomer's tale, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. Happy Friday, and thanks for being with us. Tomorrow promises to be a big day for science in Washington, D.C. The Capitol is playing host to the March for Science. There will be speakers, workshops, and yes, a march. It's all a push for science to play a bigger role in the Trump administration's policymaking. In a few minutes, we'll hear more about some of the problems march organizers have had in making the demonstration inclusive and diverse. But first, The World's Carolyn Beeler is here to tell us how the movement has expanded far beyond the Beltway.
It did start as a reaction to things happening in Washington, D.C., but it quickly spread. There are now nearly 550 satellite marches planned for around the world, and 140 of those are abroad, from Bhutan to the North Pole. The lead organizer for all these so-called satellite marches is a guy named Kishore Hari, and he says he was surprised by this big interest.
When we started, I expected there might be 50 marches, and I thought they would all be in the U.S., and quickly, we were proved wrong because there was this flood of requests, especially from communities abroad, that wanted to hold science marches for different reasons.
Are these other marches around the world, and it sounds like there's a lot of them, are they kind of in solidarity with the U.S. and trying to push the Trump administration to take stronger stands on, say, global warming, or are they responding to their own domestic concerns?
There is this idea of solidarity and that all these marches on the same day send a bigger message than individual marches. But what really struck me when I was speaking to organizers of the global marches is that local issues are really motivating each individual march. So I spoke to Renee Schroeder, who's a geneticist who's going to be marching in Vienna on Saturday. And she says she's marching in a way against the populist and far-right movement that's rising in Europe that she sees as sort of anti-enlightenment.
I am concerned, and many people are concerned, that we have to speak up again for science and for rational decisions. All these things we have been fighting for the last 50, 60 years.
And in France, organizers are really hoping to rile up pro-science folks at the demonstration on Saturday so that they'll turn out to the polls on Sunday.
So it sounds like in Europe, they're really linking science to trying to counter a populist political movement. But is that the case with the marches happening in far-flung parts of the world outside of Europe and North America?
So the motivations are really different all around the globe. So I spoke to a Nigerian, Cheche Isaac, who's an organizer of the march in the capital of Abuja. And she says that the march there is largely focused on actually pushing for acceptance of genetically modified crops there.
We need science, especially when it comes to food security. We need GMOs. We need biotechnology to be able to feed the nation, the growing population. That's essentially why we are marching.
And in Brazil, physicist Tatiana Rapoport says their demonstration is just one that they have planned over the past several months to protest huge cuts in research funding.
Brazil had a cut in the science and technology budget of almost 50% this year. And we are marching to make the public aware of these cuts and the consequence for the development of the country.
It's interesting you pair those two, Brazil and Nigeria. Nigeria really wants GMOs, and a country like Brazil has tried to fight them forever. And, of course, Europe, who you're contrasting, Europe has been completely against GMOs. So it's really telling about what a developing country may want versus a more industrialized.
Yeah, and Carol, just as people are pushing for different things in different countries, they're also demonstrating in different ways. So actually, all these events that are happening around the world aren't marches, all of them. In Rio, where they're protesting big cuts to science funding, they're actually having what they're calling a scissors orchestra, where a bunch of people will be playing the scissors as an allusion to budget cuts. There's also a brunch for science in Singapore, not a march. There's a rally here in Boston. There are teach-ins and workshops in Ghana and in South Africa, where the march will really be focused on access to STEM education. They'll be ending at the local science museum in Cape Town to start that access to STEM education right there during the March for Science.
Carolyn, it's really interesting, but of course I have to get to the age-old question. A march is a march, but what about real action and policy? What's likely to come out of this?
That is always the question, and it's hard to say before the event has even taken place. I will say there are two unique things about this march. The first is that it's rather unprecedented. Especially in the United States, scientists have been wary of stepping into both policy and politics in the past. And since the election of Donald Trump, there's been a big movement to try to politically activate the science community. And this is a big sign of that. Second, there are some very discreet requests and asks that some of these international marches are making. And so that might make it easier for steering committees and organizers to keep their marchers involved in pushing for those policy changes long after the march is over.
The World's Carolyn Beeler. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's fair to say that the scientific community here in the U.S. has been notoriously bad at recruiting and including African Americans, Latinos, and women. And the March for Science has become something of a come-to-Jesus moment for some. Here's the world's Rupa Shenoy.
Like most things these days, it all started on Facebook. March organizers got together as a group in late January. Chanda Prescott Weinstein immediately offered to volunteer.
Because I volunteer too much, I think.
Chanda's mom's from Barbados and her dad's Jewish. She's a Harvard-trained cosmologist. By her count, the 63rd Black American woman to earn a PhD in physics. And she didn't feel comfortable with the way other march organizers responded when people brought up issues of diversity.
Best case scenario, they were thoughtless responses. Like, I thought that race didn't matter. Well, that's nice to live a life where you think race doesn't matter.
She thinks if the march was really inclusive, it would be openly against Trump and Republicans, the people whose policies are targeting undocumented immigrants or Muslims or other minorities. Instead, she says, march leaders still hope to appeal to officials like those in Flint, Michigan, who long ignored complaints about contaminated water in the mostly African-American community.
So sure, if you want to work with the people who do that, I mean, you know, on some level, like, you make your own bed.
Chanda turned down an invitation to speak at the Boston March. But she doesn't think the situation is black and white, that she's right and the organizers are wrong.
I think at this point I would say that I disagree with the alignment that they have chosen. And at the same time, I understand the optimism that people are coming to the conversation with. And maybe I don't share it. But there's a part of me that also hopes that they're right and that I'm wrong.
I asked March organizers for someone to talk to about diversity issues, and they gave me Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, an oceanographer and independent consultant, and the biracial daughter of a Jamaican immigrant. She was an early member of the March's diversity committee. Problems started when they released a statement on diversity and then kept changing it to address concerns. People complained.
And we were like, well, we're changing it to improve it based on the feedback we're getting, which seems sort of scientific. Like, you put something out in the world, people don't like it, they give you feedback, you improve it. It definitely felt like, wow, we can't win.
And then there was that whole Bill Nye thing.
Bill Nye, the science guy.
Yes, that Bill Nye from the PBS Kids Science Show. He's one of the march's honorary co-chairs. Some news outlets reported that Nye was the first pick, and organizers added two more co-chairs to appear more inclusive.
All the press focused on Bill Nye, and I was really disappointed because the narrative had become, they're bad on diversity, they're just using these people as a cover for that. And I was like, no, these are amazing people.
The co-chairs are amazing. Mexican-American Lydia Villa-Komaroff is a pioneering biologist who helped discover how to make insulin. Iraqi-American Mona Hanna Atishas, a Flint pediatrician who faced a lot of flack to help prove the water contamination there. But Ayanna says criticism continued.
No matter like who we announce as speakers, no matter how we iterate on the diversity statement, it's not enough. But there have definitely been mistakes, like especially on our social media, like there have definitely been mistakes.
All the discord's worth it, Diana says, if the science community's finally talking about its racism and sexism problems. She says the march should encourage discussion, so it makes sense to keep it nonpartisan.
No one would be talking about this at this amplitude if the March for Science didn't exist. So we want to hold Democrats and Republicans and independents and Green Party members and libertarians all accountable.
Including the ones in Flint.
This is an entire population that was betrayed by every governmental agency that was supposed to protect them.
That's Mona Hanna-Attisha. 3 years ago this week, Flint's water supply was switched to a contaminated source. Dr. Mona, as she's called, listened when her patients said something was wrong. She didn't believe state test results and, along with her team, did her own. That's what got the state to eventually acknowledge the contamination. But today, people in Flint still can't drink unfiltered tap water.
So what we see is this huge distrust of government. Some people won't even use the filters because they came from government.
Mona's familiar with betrayal. Her family fled an oppressive government in Iraq when she was a kid. But she'll still work with the authorities who betrayed Flint because it's still possible they could help her patients.
We are at a day and an age where science is being dismissed from vaccines, from climate change. We need the voice, the credible, the nonpartisan, the unbiased voice of science at the table to reaffirm that science matters and we need to believe in science and it should help influence our policy.
And yeah, Mona's heard about all the talk around diversity and Bill Nye and her appointment as co-chair.
So I understand that it's an issue, but I think there's huge other diversity issues that we need to be tackling. I think where we need to be attacking diversity is not in science labs and in medicine, but in our legislative offices.
If the current mostly white administration's cuts to environmental programs go through, Mona says there may be many more Flints. So she'll be there tomorrow, marching alongside Bill Nye with thousands of others. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
That's an excerpt from an upcoming episode of The World's podcast, Otherhood. It's about the emerging multicultural majority America. You can find Otherhood on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Time for one more story before the break. You come across some strange ads online.
Have you been thinking about becoming a piano technician?
No, never really. Not until I heard the story of Martin Backhouse. He's a piano tuner in Britain, and recently he was working on a piano donated to a local school. When Backhouse tried to play it, the keys kept sticking, so he lifted them up for a closer look.
My first amazement when I opened the piano, I thought, oh, this is just mothballs specifically wrapped, which you used to get in old pianos, but this time it was, this looks a bit odd.
Backhouse found a small package wrapped in cloth. He took out his penknife and opened one end.
And I thought, this looks like gold to me. Well, I've never come across gold like this before.
Someone else might have pocketed the loot, but not Martin Backhouse.
I actually put it back in the piano, put the casework parts back on, and went to see Kathy Dowbiggin down at the office.
She's the school's business manager. Pretty soon, more school officials got involved, and eventually the headmaster called the Hemmings family. They'd recently donated the piano, and so the school assumed it was their gold. Here was Meg Hemmings' response.
We gave it to the college, and the piano tuner found it, so that is the best outcome, yes. I hope they will do something that will benefit the children's musical ability.
It's quite a haul. 900 gold sovereigns dating to the 19th century, likely to be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. The school plans to sell it to museums and use the proceeds accordingly. And tuner Martin Backhouse? He gets half of it. Not bad for a day's work. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. In South Korea, gay soldiers are facing a witch hunt. That's according to a watchdog group that tracks abuses in the South Korean military. Military officials say they're carrying out an investigation into a specific incident from earlier this year. It was a sex video of two male soldiers that surfaced online. Here in the studio with me is The World's Matthew Bell, who just got back from reporting in South Korea. Matthew, what's the gist of these allegations about this supposed crackdown?
The charges are from a group called the Military Human Rights Center for Korea, and they investigate generally rights issues around soldiers in South Korea. And it says that the military is going after servicemen suspected of being gay, that it's using phone records and data from a gay dating app to identify suspects and then bringing them in, questioning them, and pressuring them to name names. Homosexual activity in the South Korean military is illegal, and it's punishable by up to 2 years in prison. But military service is mandatory for men in South Korea, and gays are not specifically prevented from serving.
How has the South Korean military responded to these allegations?
It says that the two men in that video you mentioned were identified, that they were arrested, and that this investigation really stemmed from that specific incident. A statement from the South Korean army has denied that it is systematically targeting gay soldiers. The law that bans homosexual intercourse specifically between soldiers, South Korean lawmakers in recent years have challenged this regulation a few times because sexual activity between members of the same sex in South Korea for South Korean citizens is not illegal, but that law for the military still stands.
South Korea is a country with a booming economy. It's got a vibrant democracy, lots of pop culture. I'm surprised to hear that being gay is still an issue there. Where does that come from?
Here's an anecdote. Korea's for the past 15 or so years has had a gay pride event in the capital of Seoul. This has gone on every year. It started off quite small. Well, in 2015, there was an attempt by the government to stop this march, and the pressure was coming in part from conservative Christian groups. Some leading pastors were out in front on this thing and saying, we got to stop this gay pride march. Well, it happened anyway. In the past couple of years, the thing has just gotten bigger. There have been thousands of people out there in the type of event that, you know, Americans would be familiar with seeing similar gay pride marches in American cities.
Matthew, we got a few more seconds. You're just back from South Korea. Tell us a bit about the stories you're going to be reporting on.
So most of the work I did was focused on religion reporting. I've got a story coming up about Buddhists and their connections to political issues there. They've got a presidential race coming up in May in South Korea. I've got stories where I visited the biggest megachurch in the world, a Protestant megachurch called the Yoido Full Gospel Church. I also talked to some Catholic activists who are involved in anti-nuclear protests, and then I visited a very controversial cult.
Can't wait to hear the stories. The world's Matthew Bell. Thanks a lot, Matthew.
Thank you, Carol.
This next story is not an easy one. In fact, we want to warn you that it contains some graphic descriptions of violence against women. It's about FGM, female genital mutilation. About 200 million women around the world have had FGM performed on them. We usually hear about this being done in other countries. But just a few days ago, a doctor in Michigan was arrested on charges of performing FGM. It's one of an increasing number of cases being detected here in the U.S. From New York, the world's Jasmine Garst reports.
Let me tell you about my story. This is how it happened, and this is how I feel about it, and this is why I'm fighting.
This is Adama. She pounds on her chest proudly as she says this to me. She has an enormous smile and a stylish shock of short hair. Adama is originally from the Gambia. She's 23 years old, and when she was a little kid, her mother told her,
"You're going to go visit your aunt, and then when you come back, we're going to take you to school." And that's how it happens.
She was 7 years old, and what happened is that her genitals were mutilated, which is really common where Adama is from. In fact, when she went to school, she found most of the girls were also mutilated.
In my class, all of them.
Adama says she asked her mother,
"Why did you take me for this woman to actually mutilate me?"
And her mother responded,
"Well, you know, when you're mutilated, you're able to control yourself."
Her mother wanted her to be able to control any sexual impulses. And the idea behind mutilating girls is that they remain virgins until marriage.
It's ultimately about controlling female sexuality.
That's Dr. Deborah Ottenheimer. She works with FGM survivors.
So there are a lot of medical side effects. Difficulty with menstrual periods afterwards, chronic vaginal infections. They have a higher rate of complications with birth.
She started working with FGM victims in the Bronx, which at the time was receiving an influx of Somali immigrants. But Ottenheimer says,
this is not an African problem. Most of the cases that we know of are from Africa, but there is a huge number of women that we now know about in Indonesia who've been cut, as well as Kurdish women, as well as the Boho women of India.
In 1996, the U.S. passed a law criminalizing the practice and also making it illegal to send a girl abroad to undergo the procedure. But just last week, a doctor in Michigan became the first person in the country to be arrested on charges of performing mutilations. Mariama Diallo, a social worker in New York, says she's not surprised.
There are some anecdotes in the community that there are people who are doing it here.
Diallo works with Sanctuary for Families, a nonprofit for gender violence. She herself is from Guinea, where over 95% of women have genital mutilation. She hosts talks here in the city in communities where it's a common practice.
The ultimate goal is to educate them to prevent it from happening to their children.
But why would a woman who went through this agonizing ritual in her home country put her own daughters through it once they live here in the U.S.?
Immigration creates a fear in families. They are so scared to lose their own identity.
Which raises all these questions, like, what if a culture's age-old tradition is considered inhumane to the rest of the world? Diallo says, in her mind, there is no question.
We cannot please someone else's culture while we're harming a child. It is child abuse.
I ask her how she thinks this practice could be eradicated, and she says men are the key.
Men need to feel comfortable to come forward to say, yes, I am proud to marry a woman who is not mutilated.
Until that happens, Diallo is helping the women who suffered mutilation move forward. She hosts support groups in which she gathers survivors to talk about what they went through.
You know, it's amazing to see how much these women are. They are so strong.
I'm still a woman, okay?
It's something Adama, the woman who survived FGM in the Gambia, has given a lot of thought to.
It just happened, but I'm still a woman.
Her dream is to study international relations and go back to the Gambia to help stop female genital mutilation. She's got a youthful eagerness. She wants to eat the world up. If I had met her on the subway, I wouldn't think there was anything different about her. Every morning when she wakes up, she says she tells herself that there's nothing wrong with her. I ask her what she told herself this morning.
I'm the greatest.
For The World, I'm Jasmine Garst, New York City.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, the Iranian-American astronomer who knew at age 12 what she wanted to do with her life.
It was huge because all my friends were PhD students and cosmologists. And I would jump in and ask any question that I want.
Sona Husseini's story, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Yesterday's deadly terror attack in Paris, just 3 days before the presidential election there, is giving political ammunition to France's far right. National Front presidential candidate Marine Le Pen wasted no time trying to capitalize on the attack this morning. At a press conference, she called for France's border checks to be reinstated immediately and for foreigners on security watch lists to be expelled.
It's about taking exactly the opposite direction to that taken by the government of the right and the left that we have seen in past years. If elected as President of the Republic, I will immediately and without weakness put in place a battle plan to fight Islamic terrorism and the culture of impunity to protect the French for the Republic and for France.
In response, French Prime Minister Bernard Cazeneuve blasted Le Pen for trying to take political advantage of the attack.
La candidate du Front National cherche comme après chaque drame.
The National Front candidate is looking, as she does after every tragedy,
to profit from it and to use it to divide. She's shamelessly looking to exploit fear and emotion for wholly political ends. Nothing in the investigation, no information, leads me to make any links between immigration and asylum and what happened last night in Paris.
It's already been chaotic and unpredictable in the lead-up to this weekend's vote. And reporter Adeline Sear, normally based in France, has been following it closely. She joins me now in the studio. Adele, let's start with last night's attack in Paris. You know, a man shot dead a policeman in the Champs-Élysées. It's just a few days before the election. The Islamic State's claimed responsibility. How do you think this might impact the race?
I think it's going to make it even more confusing for a lot of people. In France, the presidential election is sort of the mother of all elections. Generally, the voter turnout is at about 70 or 80%. But we also know that about 40% of French voters don't really know who they want to vote for. So while I saw a lot of calls on social media to vote for Marine Le Pen, some deemed her, you know, the only candidate who can take this on, who can take radical Islam on, you know, that might have an effect and might actually help her. At the same time, other voters may mobilize to vote against her because for a large number of French people, she is really demonized and they see her as a threat to the Republic. So it's probably a little bit more confusing now than just 2 days ago.
Now, we've been talking about Marine Le Pen, far-right candidate. Remind us who the other candidates are in the race.
So, Carol, as we mentioned, there's Marine Le Pen, the far-right candidate who wants to restore borders, exit the European Union, return the currency to the French franc, you know, abandon the euro. And Emmanuel Macron, who is the leading candidate at the moment, sort of an unknown quantity, was finance minister under Hollande, so deemed a socialist, but he really labeled himself independent, which no French person knows exactly what that means. We have François Fillon, conservative candidate, who basically shot himself in the foot with a bunch of scandals linked to alleged fake jobs for his family. Benoît Hamon, socialist candidate, a true heir to François Hollande, who's so low in approval ratings now that Hamon has no chance, basically, of making it to the second round. And Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a very colorful personality, sort of far left, you would say, though he also has sort of center, more like centrist ideas, a very colorful personality who surprisingly rose in the polls and has a lot of charisma.
Adele, you're French. You've seen a lot of elections. We keep hearing that this election in France is unprecedented. In what way?
Well, for some of the reasons that I said, we have the leading candidate is an independent candidate. I don't even think that the French people understand what that means because nobody has this can accept the idea that someone can be actually standing in the center using ideas from the right and the left. We have yet to see this in action. It's never happened before. No president has ever been elected with an independent program, so that's very unusual. And then, of course, we have this background of terrorist attacks for a couple of years now. And surprisingly, the candidates did not seem to have, except for Marine Le Pen, who's very coherent in her far-right views, no one seemed to have a very coherent approach to fight this, which explains that a lot of French people are undecided about who to vote for.
Okay. Adele, you're here in Boston, and I know you're voting on Sunday here in Boston. How does that work?
There's an international school in Boston that becomes, for a time, French territory. And then you actually have, you know, voting booths and then you go in and you walk there. I'll probably bring my children. And we've been talking about the election nonstop for a few months, both the American election and the French election. They're sort of equally interested in both, you know, being dual citizens. And then we'll have to wait for the results, which will come around about 2 p.m. local time here. So it'll be early. But, you know, we'll be on pins and needles until then.
Reporter Adeline Sear. She's French, and she often reports to us from France. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Carol. You're welcome.
French identity, and particularly its compatibility with Islam, has been a major flashpoint in the elections this year. Over the summer, France made news when several beach towns banned the burkini, modest swimwear worn by some Muslim women. But in all the talk about Islam and Muslim women, there's been a noticeable absence, the voices of actual Muslim women. So last year, a group of women launched an online magazine to address what they say is a consistent lack of Muslim women's voices in public life, even on issues that directly affect them. It's called La Lab. Emma Jacobs reports from Paris.
There's a story Sarah Zouak tells about why she co-founded Le Lab. It happened when she was in university and brought her planned thesis topic to her advisor, a prominent French feminist. Zouak wanted to write about Muslim feminists.
She said, "But that's nonsense, Sarah. You need to choose. Either you're a feminist or you're a Muslim."
Zouak was born in France to parents who emigrated from Morocco. And she often felt torn between her various identities growing up.
For a lot of feminists, religion is a problem for the emancipation of women, especially Islam, which is seen as a sexist, misogynist religion.
The name Le Lab is a combination of the Arabic word for woman and the word laboratory. Zouak sees it as an experiment to try to change preconceptions about Muslim women that come from the political left and right. The symbol of this debate in France is the headscarf, or hijab. Zouak, by the way, doesn't wear one. Many Muslim women in France don't. But so far, one of the most popular articles on Le Lab is by a French woman who does wear a hijab. She wrote about her personal struggle with whether to remain in France or leave the country.
This summer, I went for a walk on the beach, and I just took a book and sat there with my regular clothes, and I had so many negative comments from people and insults.
The writer asked us to refer to her by just her first name, Emna, to protect her identity. She gets a lot of online abuse, and she says she already encounters enough hostility in her daily life because she wears a hijab. The French Council Against Islamophobia in France says women in headscarves face more physical and verbal attacks than Muslim men because they're so visible. Emna hesitated a long time before deciding to start wearing a headscarf in her early 20s because of the personal and professional consequences. It's not uncommon in France for a woman to be asked to remove her headscarf as a condition for employment.
It was very difficult with my parents too. Well, they were telling me, Emna, you studied, like, you have a master's degree or you're going to have a master's degree, and you want to spoil everything and just be condemned to stay at home. Is that really what you want?
But in recent months, she's become more frustrated by the political climate and the verbal abuse she gets on the street and online. This is part of why she leapt at the opportunity to write for Le Lab.
We talk constantly about Muslims and especially Muslim women, but you never get to hear them or to hear us.
France's media culture plays a part in that. It relies heavily on analysts and experts. And at this point, there are only a small number of Muslim women in the country's political and intellectual elite. In January, another Le Lab organizer, Attica Trabelsi, participated in a primetime debate on French television with former Prime Minister Manuel Valls. This was not long after controversial remarks the socialist presidential candidate had made on the campaign trail. Valls said the symbol of France was the figure of Marianne with the bare breast, not a veiled woman.
J'aimerais me reconnaître dans votre message en tant que femme.
I'd like to think of myself as someone able to make choices freely for myself, said Trabelsi, who covers her hair. A bare head or covered head, it's exactly the same thing. No, he said, I don't think so. By the next day, Le Lab's inbox and social media were flooded with comments, says Sarah Zouak.
We got a lot of support, but also lots and lots of attacks, particularly on Twitter and Facebook. Lots of hate mail that said a covered woman like that in France on TV is not okay, et cetera, et cetera. But we say if there's no criticism, that means we're not doing our job well.
If you want to change the world, it's normal to have critics, she says. It means you're shaking up the way people think. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
Most of us look on in horror at the various conflicts currently raging in Syria, but not the regime in North Korea. That's because Kim Jong-un's government has made a lot of money by selling weapons and ammunition to fellow dictator Bashar al-Assad. The North Koreans also benefit from seeing how well those weapons work and the tactics for using them. Bruce Bechtel is at Angelo State University in Texas. He published a paper on all this in 2015 for the Korean Journal of Defense Analysis. Bruce, what kind of stuff are they selling to Assad?
Excellent question, and I agree with you that it's interesting that there hasn't been a lot of hype about this. We've seen almost nothing, especially the past couple of years. But to tell you the kind of things that they're selling, start off with, for example, the Type 73 machine gun, a machine gun that's made only in North Korea. It's now been cited. I have pictures of it. They'll be in my next book. Cited not only in Syria, but in Yemen by the Houthis, and the Iranian army is using it as well as Hezbollah. But it first started being used in Iran and Syria. So that's one example, going all the way down to a small arms like a machine gun. Rocket-propelled grenades, tanks, trucks. We have reports of North Korean pilots flying helicopters for the Syrian Air Force. North Korean technicians and specialists put together the facilities that actually arm the chemical weapons that the Syrians use, and they provided the platforms for them. The Scud missile, the Scud-D, is one they've really been experimenting with a lot, and the primary platform that the Syrians have been using, which is the 122-millimeter multiple rocket launcher, yes, sold to them by North Koreans.
I want to follow up, though. You mentioned chemical weapons. What aspect of chemical weapons are the North Koreans providing to Syria, and is there any evidence that any of that was used in this recent chemical weapon attack?
I would be stunned. I would be surprised if this wasn't chemical weapons provided by the North Koreans. Because let me, please allow me to share with you that the North Koreans are the main supplier of Syria's chemical weapons. As I said, they actually built the chemical weapons facilities for the Syrians that exist in Syria today.
I'm a little confused because I thought there was a United Nations arms embargo against selling arms to Assad. How are these weapons from North Korea getting through?
Well, it's not only an arms embargo against Assad. Remember, the North Koreans are under heavy sanction, too. So both of those countries are sanctioned. North Korea does, in the Middle East alone, according to Larry Nish of the Congressional Research Service, about $3 billion worth of arms sales a year.
So how are they getting through, though, with this UN arms embargo in place?
Some of the stuff comes in via aircraft, but the majority of stuff that the North Koreans are selling to the Syrians are coming in via maritime means. And what North Korea does is very clever. They'll put, you know, arms under a bunch of concrete or a bunch of kim, which is dried seaweed or whatever, and then it'll be on a ship that's not flagged in North Korea. So all of North Korea's merchant ships are banned from doing trade. But if the ship is flying under the flag of Tanzania or, you know, Mongolia or Vietnam, how are they to know that that's a North Korean ship unless they've got excellent intelligence that tells them that? So their maritime means are very clever. From time to time, we being the international community, we catch North Korean ships that are on flags of other nations carrying these arms of all kinds. But it's a rarity. It's an anomaly. They're very good at getting past international sanctions.
How significant is the income North Korea gets from all these arms sales to North Korea, period?
Very, very significant. And I'm glad you asked me that. But illicit activity is worth more than 40% of the real North Korean economy. And of that 40%, at least two-thirds of it is weapons proliferation, arms sales.
Bruce, I'm going to back announce you, and I have to know the name of your book.
The name of my book is Enabling Instability and Violence, North Korean Proliferation in the Middle East and Africa. And it comes out next year.
Bruce Bechtel is at Angelo State University in Texas. Bruce, thank you.
Thank you. It was nice to talk to you.
I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World.
Watch out for your steps. Oh, these doors are heavy.
This is Sona Hosseini taking us through the doors of Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles.
We are going up the stairs to the roof of the building.
She exits the stairwell and stands next to a dome that holds one of the observatory's telescopes.
It feels like home.
And not just in L.A. Sona Hosseini is at home anywhere associated with outer space.
It's been a long friendship between me and astronomy.
That friendship started in Texas when she was in the first grade. The World's Ari Daniel picks up the story.
When Sona Hosseini was 7 years old, she went on a class trip to NASA's Space Center in Houston.
They give us a tour, and then suddenly they take us to a planetarium.
The planetarium show was unlike anything Sona had ever seen. Entire worlds dancing before her eyes.
This lady told us, hold tight, we are going to the moon and we are going to the sun, and the entire scene would change, and we would zoom into a planet and hop from one planet to the other planet. And I was so furious when my classmates were talking and not paying attention. I was like, hey, you know, shut up, I'm listening.
Something powerful was welling up inside Sona.
I was touched beyond my own understanding of how deep I could be touched. And I remember crying. I didn't want to leave the center. I was asking the lady, how can I work here? The lady told me, oh, honey, you should have a PhD. I didn't know what a PhD was. My best choice was like to go home and tell my mom I need a PhD. We'll go and buy it. And next thing, I'll be back there.
And she came home and said, Mom, let's go buy the PhD.
Sona's mom, Shahla Mohandasi, couldn't buy her daughter the degree, but she could buy her other things.
My pillows, my blanket, my posters in the wall, everything was like nice pictures of the planets.
At school, Sona made every project in every class about outer space. Her mom says she just couldn't take her eyes off the sky.
Always she looked at the sky. Always. When we go shopping, she never look at the clothes, makeup, nothing. She just looked at the sky. Mom, I want to go there.
But first she went to Iran. Her parents are Iranian, and they wanted their children to grow up in Iranian culture. So in 1992, at the age of 11, Sona and her family returned to the city of Zanjan. The move took her 7,300 miles on Earth, and it put the stars beyond her reach.
There were no astronomy-themed pillowcases in Iran.
There were no planetariums in Zanjan, and her mom says none of Sona's school teachers could foster her particular streak of curiosity.
It was hard. Because nobody knows what's the astronomy. All her question
about astronomy and galaxy and solar system,
nobody can answer.
And I was made fun of. And I would come home crying every day.
So Sona's parents tracked down one of the best basic science universities in all of Iran, which happened to be in Zanjan. And they met with the director, who happened to be a cosmologist.
And then he told my mom, well, okay, then Sona can hang out here after school. And that's what I did.
Most days after lunch, Sona went to the university. She was about 12 at the time.
It was huge because all my friends were PhD students and cosmologists. And I would jump in and ask any question that I want. And I never learned how to be shy in science.
Sona went to college in Iran and did her master's there too. Then she returned to the U.S., to UC Davis, for that thing she'd wanted since she was 7, her PhD in engineering applied science.
I knew I wanted to build and design in a small instrument and do science with it.
To examine the light pouring off of big targets in space.
Like comets, planetary atmospheres.
All to figure out what they're made of. The closest facility where she could do her work was on a mountaintop. The place was isolated, and Sona worked the night shift.
I do not remember, son.
She rarely saw another soul. All Sona did was work, and gradually she slipped into depression.
It was a very dark time for me, very unhealthy.
Night after night, as she worked on her instrument, the irony of her situation just deepened her sadness.
I was building an instrument to gather light, and here I was in darkness.
I mean, here you were. You'd finally arrived at the place you'd wanted to be for so long. And it was so...
And I was sad.
Yeah, it was so sad.
I was exactly where I wanted. My dream was to be in an observatory. That was my dream growing up. And it was so sad.
Hmm.
I drowned myself. Putting all these expectations on myself, it almost suffocated me.
Her mom tried to break her out of it.
I told to her, Sona, listen to this music. Sona, do you want to make that food? I did everything I knew. I told her, go to some restaurant and dance. She loved dance.
She was like, you have to start taking these things as a pill. You have to go down the mountain, meet your friends twice a week.
It was the mountain and her family that taught Sona a lasting lesson about the universe, that sometimes the stars glow their brightest when you're right here on Earth.
And it took me about 2 years to recover from it.
It was like you had finally touched the stars.
And when you did, and you looked around, you were alone. And it was the things of the earth, you know? It was the calligraphy.
Yeah.
It was the dance. It was human contact. That's what restored you.
I learned that the stars were beautiful in company with other things that I was doing.
For The World, I'm Ari Daniel.
That story comes to us from a live show called Stories Under the Stars. It was co-produced by Ari and the Charles Hayden Planetarium at the Museum of Science in Boston. Just enough time left to tell you about a story we're working on for next week. It's about a unique exchange program for school kids in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. The kids get to spend a week speaking a different language and living in a different culture. But they do it without leaving town. It's a program called City Stay, and a ninth grader named Armand is taking part in it. His private school places him with a Peruvian family living in the Twin Cities. And by the end of the week, Armand's host mother, Alicia, is not ready to let him go.
Oy, Armando.
Oh. I'll see you soon.
Okay. Call me, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
You stay safe, okay?
Okay. Thank you so much, yeah. Armando.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a
day. The City Stay program was created by a teacher who sees this as more than a language program. It's about making connections.
And I love the idea of being able to have lasting relationships with our neighbors and to continue learning from one another and advocating for one another.
We'll have that story next week, so be sure to tune in. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman's back on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Public Radio International.